Hi, everybody. We're in Laws of the Soul, webinar commentaries number 7. We're working in the law of sacrifice. And we're into some very interesting ideas that the majority of monads, of human monads, in the three schemes we've been discussing, Saturn, Mars, and Earth scheme, are on the third ray, the ray of active intelligence expressing itself through the 7 ray types, is above everything else the ray upon which the majority of human monads will at this particular at this time be found. Now, I think he means, especially with these three schemes, it can't be the majority in the solar system, because we know that there are 35 billion human monads in the solar system that are on the second ray, and 20 billion on the third. So that's not a majority. It has to be with respect to the three planets we've been discussing, which are uniquely planets of sacrifice, as we generally understand the term sacrifice. So a hint is here given as to the prevalence of third-ray monads among the sons of men, the ray of active intelligence expressing itself through the 7 ray types, and then we've talked about what exactly does that mean, is that soul rays or the 7 monadic types, is above everything else the ray upon which the majority of human monads will, particularly at this time, and I do think... we have to clarify that, of course, particularly at this time and in relation to the three schemes here discussed, be found. We shall therefore find the following psychological types coloring the bulk of humanity and the ray of active intelligence as a monadic ray. I want to say a monadic ray, but let's say the monadic ray as the monadic ray, expressing itself through will, evoking divine purpose. And when the will is rightly aligned, the purpose is seen and understood. So we might say that he that does the will of God shall know the divine purpose. Love, expressing divine quality, the particular quality of our solar system and our planet particularly. Intellect as the reflector of the intuition. So into the intellect comes the stream of intuition. Into the intellect descends the stream of intuition. And in the intellect it is formulated. Ideas are formulated into thoughts. There, abstract thoughts. Conflict producing harmony. Notice that conflict is mentioned first. And this has been often called the ray of conflict, but sometimes it's called the ray of harmony through conflict, emphasizing the end result. But here, the ray of conflict producing harmony. He turns it the other way around. Knowledge or science. It's not the same as intellect, is it? Intellect is particularly related to the third ray, and knowledge to the fifth ray, although we should not make any truly hard and fast distinction. There tends to be that type of relationship. Knowledge or science leading to radiance, the way of bringing the potential, the radiatory potential of matter forward. So, bringing into expression the radiatory potential of matter by means of knowledge. Idealism establishing the divine pattern. It connects with the divine pattern on the monadic plane, and it works at bringing that pattern through into different fields. It works hard. Its vision is ultimately the vision of the divine pattern. The vision in the higher types of those upon the sixth ray is the vision of the divine pattern. And ritual or organization manifesting deity, that's straightforward. Now the question is, are we speaking of, well, we're certainly speaking of soul types, that's for sure. We're speaking of soul types through which the third ray monad expresses. But we might also be speaking of monadic types on the monadic plane through which the major monadic ray expresses. So that is something else to consider, that there are seven monadic types, not just three. Three in essence, three in synthesis, and maybe three perhaps upon the logoic plane. The monad does not cease to exist upon the monadic plane, but the monadic vehicle is no longer a hindrance. We don't know when that monadic vehicle is destroyed, but we do know that the Christ and the Buddha have a focus on the logoic plane, and they, well, any unit of life leaving the cosmic physical plane has to be considered a monad in departure, even if the monadic vehicle is not there, and even if they lose touch, either permanently or for a time, with the cosmic physical plane. So there are seven monadic types on the monadic plane, and there are also seven soul types. In any case, the third ray monad, and maybe we can consider it the major ray, expresses through either one of those. Okay. Therefore, psychologically speaking, well, see, when he uses the word psyche, you know, the word psyche does suggest the soul and the soul level. Of course, there is also a type of monadic psychology, and we are introduced somewhat to it in this book, Esoteric Psychology, although it remains an esoteric factor because DK doesn't really say, well, now we're dealing with monadic psychology. But if you do study the Blessed Ones carefully, you realize we're talking about the monad in incarnation on its pilgrimage. We're not simply speaking of the soul, though in a way the soul is the monad, plus the presence of the angel of the presence and that type of consciousness fusing with the consciousness of the human being or monad. The human being is a monad. He even uses the word people to describe monads of certain types. So human being equals person equals monad. It's a different kind of equivalence. We just have to understand that the monad is really all there is, the one is all there is, and whatever field of expression we may be focused upon, it is the monad that is expressing and the monad that is sensitive and receiving. Therefore, psychologically speaking, when greater knowledge has been gained of the energies determining the type of a person, for instance, whose monad is presumably upon the third ray, well, he uses the word presumably because it's so hard to tell. It is the X factor. It is the unknown factor in the majority of cases. In these three schemes, his ego, and notice he doesn't capitalize the word ego, but he does mean on the higher mental plane. He rarely uses the term ego to represent the personality. That is more the use of modern psychology, talking about the ego. We have to specify lower ego when we want to mean the person or the personality or the isolated individual. Normally the term ego, whether capitalized or not capitalized, is meaning something higher, and if it is capitalized, it generally means something even higher, some sort of triadal identity. And maybe when all the letters are capitalized, it can even mean the monad itself in its monadic egg, auric egg, ego, egg. Okay. A person, for instance, whose monad is presumably upon the third ray, his ego being on the fourth ray, that we're talking about the future now, not so many of these, and his personality upon the seventh ray will be described as a, and then we spell out the word three, and then we use the Roman numeral four, and then the Arabic numeral seven to describe the personality. So this will be, here we have a language of delineation for the future and emerging science. Okay, science of Esso. Yeah, I think I'll do that one too, if I may. Trying to find ways of facilitating the writing and making sure the spelling is correct. Once correct, always correct. Once wrong, always wrong. Science of esoteric psychology, with no at sign. SOEP, science of esoteric psychology. So, all right, it will be a long time. There will be many monads on the third ray passing through our particular schemes and on our Earth scheme. But not so many fourth ray souls yet, but coming in. So this will be the terminology, this will be the formula by which we describe such people. And when a master looks at such a formula, he knows somewhat what to expect, depending upon the stage of evolution at which the individual, the unit of consciousness, finds himself. Within this simple formula, there will be lesser differentiations, and a seventh-ray personality may have, for instance, a first-ray mental body, a fifth-ray astral body. Ha, ha, he's throwing one in there, isn't he? Because of all of his students, maybe depending upon the stage of human history in which he was teaching, but then none of them had the fifth-ray astral body. Only astral bodies on the sixth, second, and first rays. And a third-ray physical body. The formula which would describe him then would be as follows. So the written word three, then the Roman numeral four, then seven. And, aha, we have to see whether we can get this in here. Possibly. Well, I am used to seeing a ray chart differently arranged, and when it says symbol here in the book or on the CD, it made me think that perhaps there's something missing that is in the book. I don't have the book handy with me right now, but anyway, DK goes on to interpret this, and it is an unusual chart. Not only for the fourth ray soul, which is certainly, or ego, which is certainly possible, but for the fifth ray astral body. Look at this. Whoa. This is a very hard line chart. Only the, only the ego is on the soft line, and all else on the hard line. So somehow this fourth ray must bring in the balancing factor. There will be, you know, a highly intelligent individual here in control of the astral body and capable of great activity upon the physical plane, a real organizer, but maybe organizing in beauty for the sake of creative intelligence. Well, a ray chart can mean many things, depending on the stage of evolution of the individual, whether he can access all of these energies or not, and on the astrological chart at the particular time, as that will be a great modifying factor. There are many modifying factors. Let's see what DK says about this. You see how he put this in? So this is unusual, and is here to show that it is possible to have such an astral body. He talks sometimes about the third ray astral body. I think there's also a sample chart with the seventh ray astral body. But it seems to me that some sort of issue concerning balance would be needed, but it looks like perhaps a very creative chart, but the emotional body would not be engaged so much. It would be a higher type of creativity. Usually there would be detachment from emotional states, I would imagine, and the ability to mentalize them, to understand them knowledgeably with the fifth ray astral body and so many hardline rays. Students may find it of value to study themselves and others in conformity with the above. Well, I can tell you I've spent more than half my life doing that precisely. And, you know, stimulated 40-some years ago by reading esoteric psychology, I got right into this and wondered whether it would be possible to create ray charts for people that would be useful in helping them with their spiritual process and also their living in their world, in the normal world. So students may find it of value to study themselves and others in conformity with the above. And in our esoteric psychology courses, in the Great Quest aspect of the Maurya Federation, we do exactly that, and we have done that in esoteric psychology courses taught in many places on the globe through the University of Seven Rays in person. Now we have the possibility of teaching over the net, which certainly saves the gasoline. Students will find it of value to study themselves and others in conformity with the above and to establish their personal ray formulae. And this should be done in conjunction with the consultation of the horoscope. Absolutely, because the same ray chart will reveal or express them very differently through different horoscopes, and very identical horoscopes will express differently depending on the ray chart, which could be quite different. This will be discussed more at length after we have considered the astrological implications of the rays. Well, we have the advantage of the spherical study because we have been already presented with what D.K. was going later to present when he wrote this. This was written in the, I suppose, the earlier middle 30s, and the astrology maybe in the middle, later, and 30s and early 40s. So we've been given the connections, and now so much of what he said earlier can be related to what he said later. So we can study in a manner that is more relational than would have been possible. It would be a more linear study in those early days when the entirety of the teaching he intended to give had not been yet given. So this will be discussed more at length after we have considered the astrological implications of the rays in the succeeding volume. You can imagine what it has been for Master D.K. to translate so much of this, which he probably learned in some sort of Eastern mode, although he had two European incarnations, he tells us. But he had the advanced astrology of the Eastern teaching, and it had to be translated into Western form for the Western mind to assimilate. The law of sacrifice, therefore, can never be eliminated in our Earth scheme as far as the human and sub-human reactions to sorrow and pain are concerned. It can be eliminated in the superhuman response. Can be eliminated in the superhuman response, but apparently our planetary logos suffers and is in the midst of a sacrifice which he likes not. Well, maybe by now he likes it more. We've been talking a long time. We've been talking of ages ago when the old commentary said he returned and he liked it not. But probably he has seen somewhat of the fruit of his labors, and the redemptive mission has been carried through, and that must bring some compensation, though who can tell when you're speculating about the consciousness of a planetary logos. Anyway, we anthropomorphize a little bit, we analogize, we project. So it can never be eliminated in terms of the four lower kingdoms. Interestingly enough, the number four again, right? So note the number four and its relation to the fourth ray and the law of sacrifice ruled by the fourth ray. So four is in many ways, along with two, but I'll just say four here, four is the number of suffering. And you can see that even physically on the faces of the people who have powerful fourth ray. Corrugated forehead, the worried look. Am I giving it sufficiently? Oh, my life is strange and wonderful. So as far as the human and subhuman reactions to sorrow and pain are concerned, it cannot be eliminated from our Earth, at least not yet. We're too much in the throes of that friction in which we try to reconcile the energies of the previous and the present solar system. Nor can it be eliminated on the planets Saturn and Mars, but we are not told of the nature of the Saturnian school. We are told something of the nature of the Martian school for warriors and destroyers, and I suppose suffering is involved in that, learning the gladiatorial schools in Rome were very, very hard, and if people did not make the grade, they simply died among their own. Forget about being in the arena and dying as a result of the opponent. One's fellow students could easily kill one. In some of the predecessory combats to see who was worthy to actually enter the arena. So, Saturnian, I would like to look at that, S-A-T-N, and that's Saturn and Saturnian. I think we could use an abbreviation there. So this suffering, this sorrow, this pain, this loss, this incompleteness, this division is relatively unknown in the other schemes. Bliss and sacrifice are synonymous terms as far as the solar logos is concerned, and also for the majority of the planetary logoi, and maybe one day for the Earth too. One day for the planetary logos of the Earth. Earth scheme. This must be remembered. So the impulse of giving is the impulse leading to bliss. That's what we're being told. To those who give, all shall be given, all desires satisfied, and bliss will be the result. So the implication is, give everything you can in right measure, wisely, helpfully, not just a dump, you know, unloading the information dump, which some of us teachers have been accused of offering our students, but the right type of giving, giving all that may be rightfully given, this leads to bliss, and I suppose becomes bliss itself. The giving becomes the bliss. Well, let's try it sometimes, you know. Then surely if you do try it, you'll disappear from this planet or this particular level, and if you return, it will be voluntary. So to give all is to find release from the obligations of the lower spheres and to enter into the state of bliss, but then one wants to continue to give all so one may return. Anyway, bliss and sacrifice are synonymous terms as far as our solar logos is concerned, and also for the majority of the planetary logos. Well, does he mean every other planetary logos other than the logos of Saturn, Mars, and Earth, or are there some for whom bliss and sacrifice are not yet synonymous terms? But we could well remember this, could we not? That bliss is giving, well, sacrifice is giving, giving is sacrifice, and sacrifice is bliss. Giving is bliss. Ergo, giving is bliss. Oh, is bliss. This must be remembered. A touch of this freedom from the limitations of pain and sorrow can be found among the more advanced sons of men on earth who know this combination, the ecstasy of the mystic, the exaltation of the initiate, and the exquisite agony of sacrifice or of any feeling which is carried forward to the point of sublimation. This is a very occult statement. And again, it invites us to practice. The ecstasy, I suppose one can lose oneself in ecstasy. It's a heightened feeling state, a happiness beyond compare, a heightened feeling state, a happiness beyond compare. We could say that in ecstasy, things cannot get any better. Well, it's a bit like bliss in that respect. But I think lower and less controlled than bliss. Ecstasy seems to have something of this element of potential loss of control or lack of relation to the surroundings. The exaltation rising to the highest point. Let the forces come together, let them mount to the high place, and from that lofty eminence, let the soul look out upon a world destroyed. So there is the rising to the peak of one's present energy system, we could say. The rising to the peak or summit of one's present energy system. And then, does this look too inviting? The exquisite agony of sacrifice, or of any feeling which is carried forward to the point of sublimation, it then is no longer itself and turns into something altogether more beautiful. It is no longer itself and turns into something much higher and more beautiful. But are we willing to go through the exquisite agony? This moment of agony, as we seize the cup, all of us will seize it at some point and then find ourselves translated into another state altogether beyond the three lower worlds. Transfiguration still relates to the mental plane, but not translation. That relates to the Buddhic plane, and we can think that this exquisite agony of sacrifice has some connection to Buddha. Exquisite agony of sacrifice may have some connection with the Buddhic consciousness. When this has been reached, the ecstasy of the mystic, the exaltation of the initiate, all beyond the fourth kingdom and the lower kingdoms, and the exquisite agony of sacrifice or of any feeling which is carried forward to the point of sublimation, when it one is reminded of the sublimation of iodine in the chem lab, you know. You put the flame under it and it doesn't turn into a liquid. It's interesting. It moves from the solid state into the vaporous state. So you see iodine, a chemical with a violet color. Interesting, its antiseptic qualities in relation to the color violet, which is a purificatory color, rises into a vapor. It becomes sublimated. So our feelings, perhaps, well, they rise toward the Buddhic plane, we might say. When this point of suffering has been reached, then the mechanism of suffering and the ability to register sensuous perception is transcended. Sensuous perception, presumably astral perception, and the perception mediated by the lower senses of the physical plane. That is transcended, and momentarily a man escapes onto the plane of unity. Indeed, so, yes, we are speaking of Buddha, aren't we? We are here. Whoa, is there a way to do this? Let's see. So, we are speaking of escape to the Buddhic plane. Plane of unity. Arising through harmony. Well, sometimes, you know, you could say, well, the monadic plane is the plane of unity. It is the plane of perceived oneness, if unity is oneness. When you think about the word unity, it seems to suggest that the many still exist, but are in a harmonized and unified state. They realize not just their harmony, not just their agreeability with each other and their mutual enforcement, but they realize that though apparently different, they are all one thing. So, harmony, unity, oneness. That's the progression. Harmony, unity, oneness. And in some ways, we can look at that as a progression from the fourth ray to the second ray and thence to the first ray, though there is much appreciation of oneness in the second ray as well. But we're given the formula isolated unity to appreciate the oneness of things. And it is a first ray formula. So there's lots of overlap between these two terms. You know, no term necessarily captures the reality of the state which it represents. So the overlap between unity and oneness, isolated unity, unity usually a second ray word but found in a first ray technique, which reveals oneness. We realize the oneness of the whole. I suppose there's a state when all of the apparent difference fades out, and one literally and only sees the one everywhere he turns. And it for a moment blots out all form, hiding all difference, blotting out all form, as we are informed in Rule 11 of the Rays and the Initiations. Here there is no pain. Whoops. It would be pain if I started another program. Here there is no pain, no sorrow, no rebellion, and no suffering. All these terms, equivalent, all these terms are equivalent and represent the psychology of our planetary logos and that of Saturn and Mars to some extent. We don't know to what extent. Here there is no pain, no sorrow, no rebellion, no suffering, because there is no division. All of these factors describing undesirable states in the human consciousness Well, rebellion is not necessarily, well, at least let's say that nobody invites these states. Maybe more rebellion than anything else, but very few people invite consciously, if they have a choice, suffering, sorrow, or pain into their life. But when the unity is achieved in the higher states of consciousness than the state pertaining to the fourth kingdom, all of these disappear. When the living, vibrating antiskarana or bridge is built, this way of escape becomes the normal path of life. This is, as you say, no longer the occasional mystical escape from the astral plane to the Buddhic plane. And that is not under one's control. But the way of escape is now a scientifically controlled path. And we can escape at will. Escape from pain is then automatic, for the center of consciousness is elsewhere. Kind of wonder, I'm told a story, it may not be a true story, but, well, the astrology looks true. Mahatma Gandhi was having an appendectomy, and he refused to have the anesthetic. Now, normally you'd be knocked out of your body and completely unconscious, or there could be a local anesthetic. He refused all of that, and it said that he chatted amiably with reporters while this was going on. Well, you know, stories become exaggerated in the telling, but the idea is pretty clear. His center of consciousness was elsewhere. In the cases mentioned above, and where the antiskarana is not consummated, a consummated established fact, the tiny thread of the partially constructed way of escape, or antiskarana, under tremendous pressure and excitation, and we would say, you know, as a result of intense emotion, DK has said that sometimes the ancient words and formulas can come into the consciousness of the individual when they are in an intensely emotional state, and then we would recapture the old knowledges which have been lost to us. So sometimes this tiny thread of light, it's a thread of matter of some kind, of the partially constructed way of escape, under tremendous pressure and excitation in a intense emotion or a highly exalted emotional state, shoots forward like a quivering band of light and momentarily touches the light that is the self. And what does it touch? Is this, what is the self? Is this the soul, or is this actually the truer self, the monad? But it is not under control, really. And he says, hence the ecstasy and exaltation, but unpredictable, really. It just suddenly happens. One, these days, wants to lay a scientific approach to these possibilities so that one can enter the state of blissful abstraction at will, not as an escape, but as a strengthening, perhaps, a way of reminding oneself what's really happening, and then return, reinforced, strengthened, to the difficulties of our frictional world. So this tiny thread shoots forward like a quivering band of light and momentarily touches the light that is the self. Well, sometimes we're told that the soul is light. Is the monad also light? Well, maybe the universe is light. Maybe the universe itself is nothing but a point of light. Hence ecstasy and exaltation, very temporary, it does not last, and cannot be consciously recovered until the third initiation has been taken. And we say by that time, let's just say the soul as a center on the higher mental plane can be bypassed. As DK uses that word elsewhere, advising how this is to be done through the Antikarana technique which he has given us. Of course, there was one disciple who has rather successfully bypassed the soul and had the abstract mind and concrete mind well related, but I guess the concrete mind was not sufficiently soul-infused, because DK was advising this individual to reclaim the powers of her loving soul. So there was some balancing that had to be done. So there are mystical ecstasies and even exaltations. Again, it's hard to discriminate between those two words. The word exaltation has more structure in it, I think, than ecstasy. One possibly can become lost in ecstasy, but when exalted, one knows one's position, I suppose. But it does not last and cannot be consciously recovered until the third initiation has been taken. After that, the way of escape becomes the way of daily livingness, to translate inadequately the occult and ancient phrase. Of course, this does not mean that one lives entirely in an abstracted state of consciousness. He who faces towards the light and stands within its radiance is blinded to the issues of the world of men. He passes on the lighted way. He passes on the whatever way towards the great center of absorption, maybe the lighted way. So it's talking about the pratyeka versus the bodhisattvic attitude. But no, it's not a question of escaping and having no more concern for the world of illusion, because the world of illusion really is nothing other, essentially, than the world of reality. If we could learn that subtle method of translating appearance and illusion into perceived reality. So after that, the way of escape becomes the way of daily livingness, to translate inadequately the occult and ancient phrase. Then pain is steadily transcended, we could say, beyond the third degree, and the pairs of opposites, pleasure and pain, no longer have any hold over the disciple. At least their alternation has no hold, one would say. Their alternation has no hold. No longer pendant between the pairs of opposites. Pleasure, you know, if pleasure is bliss, if pleasure is sublimated, is bliss, then the disciple is in that extrapolated, pleasureful state. Pleasureful state. Is there such a thing as pleasureful? Is there such a word? I don't know. But I'll pretend that there is. So, simultaneously, I'm remembering about the yogi sage, Ramana Maharshi. He was, his outer form was dying, I think, of throat cancer. And one of his disciples surreptitiously touched him and became, at the moment, ecstatic with bliss. And Ramana Maharshi is reputed to have said, "Ah, you scoundrel, now you know my secret." As if, despite what was happening in the outer form, the bliss consciousness was always present. So that's certainly pleasure to the nth degree. But there is no inconsistent oscillation between pleasure and pain, but a sustained bliss even in the face of what would normally cause most people to say, I'm in a state of pain, and would preoccupy their attention. Nothing pulls the attention of the ecstatic, exalted, blissful initiate away from his focus in that world. At least he can have it at will. Of course, you look at the Master Jesus upon the cross, and obviously there was great suffering. But you also wonder in the statement, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? The robe of my strength, was it, no longer serves? Did D.K. talk about that? Are those agonized statements, or are they blissful statements? Robe, no longer, there it is. Ah, here it is, the robe. The robe, the beautiful robe of my strength, no longer serves. So the outer form no longer serves to occupy the consciousness because the consciousness is inwardly focused. My God, my solar angel, why hast thou forsaken me? Well, it's always the question of the revealing of the inner spirit, the inner fire, the blissful being. And there's another phrase embodying the central mystery, but have never yet been given out. Were these spoken by the Master, the initiate, Jesus, as he was taking the fourth initiation? Well, this is quite a extraordinary idea, that what mankind interpreted as the agony of Jesus upon the cross may have been blissful realizations. Of course, also, he experienced, says the Tibetan, the dark night of the soul upon the cross, a much higher version of the dark night, which most mystics experience. He understood the agony of humanity and its distance from the truth. The whole human condition, what is it said, dawned upon his soul. Here it is. The significance, see, at the highest point, let's see if I, Father, here it is. The significance, the intention, it's the same one. Here from the rays and the initiations. At the high point of this consummated knowledge and at the moment of his complete surrender to the necessary sacrifice of his life, to the fulfilling of the plan, suddenly a great expansion of consciousness took place. The significance, the intention, the purpose of it all, and the extent of the divine idea as it existed in the mind of the Father dawned on his soul, not on his mind, but on his soul. But this is the Christ seeing this. So I think it is the Christ. Here it is in the reappearance of the Christ also, dawned upon his soul, not his mind. This is the Gethsemane experience, so it's different from that of the Master Jesus. Master Jesus, dark night, and true Jesus. Here it is. It's about blindness. For the initiate, this blindness is still more esoteric. There remains for him absolutely no light whatsoever, no earth light, nor any light within the three worlds at all. There is only blackness. To this the mystic has given the name the dark night of the soul, the true dark night, of which the mystic's dark night is only the dim reflection, to speak paradoxically, marks a very exalted state of being and stage of development. It was into the blackness and darkness that Christ penetrated? Well, he too, as he overshadowed one of his masters, certainly the Arhat, Jesus at this point, the Master Jesus upon the cross. This will strike a new note for many and can only now be revealed. It's concerned with the facility with which a master participates in the experience subjectively realized of the disciples whom he has prepared for initiation. It relates to the still higher identification of the Christ with those initiates who are taking the fourth and fifth initiations, such as the Master Jesus in the experience referred to above. Well, okay, I had something of the idea there, but the true dark night, of course, there is another place where he talks about the agony that was perceived, humanity's condition, as he understood, as Master Jesus, or the initiate Jesus at that time, understood the condition of humanity. But I don't think I can find that right now. It is there. And I want to go looking, of course. That's my nature, to want to go looking, but I'll have to sacrifice that right now and relinquish my tendency to go off on a tangent, and I might leave that to you, or later I might do it. Oh, well, I'm really quite hopeless. I did it anyway. All right, well, here it is. It's about the dark night of the soul. The world tension increases and will increase. Anxiety grows and there is no sign of its immediate lessening. This is in Discipleship in the New Age. The darkest hour of human life is upon us and frequently brings to the earnest disciple the experience, terrible yet beautiful, to which has been given the name Dark Night of the Soul. This dark night takes different forms and different degrees of intensity according to the ray, the type, and the point of evolution of the disciple. From it, you cannot escape. But one error emerges if careful thought is given to the dark night as pictured by the mystics down the ages. Their emphasis has in the past been laid upon the suffering which the personality experiences and the agony through which the personality goes. But in reality, from the angle of the facts, that is not the true dark night. The real dark night is that of the soul as it participates, there we go, in the pain of humanity as a whole, in the agony of humanity's separation from God, a separation based upon illusion but not on actuality, and upon the desperation of humanity's reaching forth towards what appears to be an unresponsive God. Personality pain and desperation are very different things and are not concerned with the totality of pain and suffering to which mankind is subjected. And I think I might have, you know, conflated this and brought the other reference to the Master Jesus into the picture. I'm not sure whether the Master Jesus is here concerned. And I just have to see what I did. No, I didn't. I didn't include him. If I did, excuse me, there would be no reference. Anyway, I found the necessary reference. So at least we come to understand that even here on our earth, which is the planet of releasing sorrow and purifying pain, there are states beyond the consciousness of the fourth kingdom in nature, which are ecstatic, exalted, blissful, and in which an escape from pain as usually understood and sorrow and suffering can be achieved. The building of the Antikarana helps to achieve this. It is the way of escape, and after the third degree, it becomes the way of daily livingness. All of this constitutes the theme of esoteric psychology, and when rightly understood, will explain what? the Saturnian influence in human life, the god of opportunity, and, well, sometimes the deity who brings disaster, that's how it's sometimes understood, but the necessity to detach from lower enthrallments. We might say that Saturn opposes enthrallment. It's, you know, the word glamour, you look so glamorous, well, it's become a positive word. Oh, you look enthralling, it's become a positive word, and we do not realize the imprisoning implied. The cessation of rebellion, or the ending of the Martian influence. Well, there we go, you know, both planets have this factor of rebellion related to them. Our planetary logos and the planetary logos of Mars. And, you know, may it be, I'm not sure, but can it be that Mars also has the first ray monad, even as the Earth does? I've thought of the Martian monad as being primarily the fifth ray, relating it in some sense then to Mercury. They both have a lot to do with the number five, Mars with the five senses and the fiveness of the concrete mind, and Mercury so connected with the five. But for Mercury, I feel that the transition from that fifth ray monad is onto the major third ray monad for Mars. I think it could be different. Simply speculation, but I think it could be the first ray. Time will tell. Certainly is the school for destroyers, school for warriors. The cessation of rebellion, or the ending of the Martian influence, we would say, as it influences Earth. The building of the Antiskarana, which releases a man from control of the personality life. So the ancient domination of the personality is ended at the third degree. So we might say that the true usefulness, achievement of the use of the Antiskarana comes in at the third degree, when the ancient domination of the personality is ended, overcome. The evocation along that Antiskarana of group consciousness, the consequent negation of pain and sorrow, entrance into nirvana. Well, the nirvanic plane is sometimes called, the apneic plane is sometimes called the nirvanic plane, and the beginning of the real way. And this real way is the way of higher evolution. These six stages. Yes. And this is the theme of esoteric psychology. We are the monad. We are on a planet where it is necessary for us to choose between competing values, some closer to one of the pairs of opposites or the other, and we can't have both. So we're into, well, what can we call Saturn? You know, in a way, let's call it the planet of forced choice. Sometimes you have to take a test where they say, oh, but I relate to both of these. No, choose the one you relate to the most, and that's an agonizing decision. But you have to prioritize. So, in a way, Saturn is also a planet of prioritization. And then we will cease our rebellion once we start moving, towards unity. Mars is not a very unifying planet, but it certainly facilitates the move towards unity. So we end our rebellious state because we can do something about entering a higher state of unity, because we're taught how to do that. One of the methods, well, one of the methods is contacting the soul in occult meditation. Another method is more advanced. It's contacting the spiritual triad and monad through the building of the antikskarana. And one rises out of the mental unit and the personality built around it. And one rises into the realm where group consciousness prevails. And this is especially the spiritual triad. And we can say that universal consciousness prevails on the level of the monad. And then rising into these worlds which are beyond duality, we have the negation of pain and sorrow in worlds beyond duality. Well, really, duality is a very ingrained factor in our universe. But there are temporary states on this ascending 2-1, 2-1, you know, temporary states at the point where duality is temporarily negated. So the consequent negation of pain and sorrow in the higher worlds of the cosmic etheric plane, which are compared to the dense physical levels of the planetary and solar logos, they are non-dual. And entering into nirvana, what can we call it? Bliss, ecstasy, exaltation, exquisite, agony, sublimated. These are the states that lie ahead when we transcend the Earth, Mars, Saturn state of consciousness. Well, this is such an important law, you know, and I think there is an inner repulsion against studying it, lest by studying it we might have to do it. And if we still have identification as a personality, we won't want to do it. At least the personality desire body won't want to do it, although the higher will to do it. So I think that's enough for the moment, because we're just about to enter into a new section concerning the relinquishment of gain. These are rather long chapters and deserve our very focused attention. So this will be, you know, a major series of programs on an important consideration for all disciples, the laws of the soul, the laws of group life. So this will be the end of Laws of the Soul webinar commentaries number 7, EP 2, page 102, I suppose. Let's see. Yes, no, page 103. And we will be beginning with Laws of the Soul webinar commentaries number 8, EP 2, page 103. All right, lots to consider, because if we could learn in all of the little processes of life to act in conformity with the law of sacrifice, then indeed there would be elevation and release, the transcendence of duality, the transcendence of pain and sorrow, suffering, and so forth. And certainly the Buddha taught this, and the Christ, in his own way, taught this, although he insisted that his disciples would have to go through the agony to emerge on the other side. Okay, we'll see you soon.